This is Lori and Tori coming to you from the haunted corners of New England, and you're listening to the Something Wicked podcast, the show that delves deep into the topics of true crime, haunted histories, and all things paranormal. Dedicated to those that love to know all the spoopy and gruesome details about psycho serial killers, ghastly ghouls, and creepy cryptids with tales to make you sleep with the lights on. On today's episode, we are going to go over the Enfield Poltergeist. I originally wanted to include this as part of the Warren Files that we started, but I couldn't rightly call it one of their cases. Yes, this is the case that The Conjuring 2 was based off of, but as we all know, Hollywood tends to over-dramatize a lot of the based-on-true stories. So we will cover the real story of what happened to the Hodgson family way back in the 70s with this terrifying tale. So sit back, pop some corn, and let's get it. Hello, and welcome back to the show, and for those of you new to the podcast, I'll say thanks for tuning in. As we said in the intro, we are going to go over the infamous Enfield Poltergeist. This story of the Hodgson family and their haunted home became so popular that it caught the attention of major media, the police, and Hollywood, who eventually turned this case into a film as part of the Conjuring franchise. There is a lot of content that I was able to dig up, so bear with me, folks. This is going to be another two-parter. And here we go.
Whee!
In 1977, a house in the North London suburb of Enfield was the scene of violent disturbances of apparently paranormal origin. The occurrences were similar to those reported in other cases of the poltergeist type. Knockings and other noises with no apparent cause, doors opening and closing by themselves, furniture overturned, small objects hurled across rooms, picture frames ripped from walls, small fires that started and went out by themselves,
Jesus Christ,
and such like. The events continued for just over a year, and in many cases were witnessed by neighbors, investigators, technicians, press reporters and broadcasters, police officers, and others. In its later stages, the case was notable for the emergence of abusive and often obscene speech from the mouth of an 11-year-old girl. Tape recordings were made of the voice, which was gruff and masculine, apparently that of an old man. Some members of the Society of Psychical Research, such as Maurice Gross and writer Guy Lyon Playfair, believe the haunting to be genuine, while others such as Anita Gregory and John Baloff were unconvinced and found evidence the girls had faked the incidents for the benefit of the journalists. Members of the Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal, or CSICOP, including stage magicians such as Milburn Christopher and Joe Nickel, criticized paranormal investigators for being credulous whilst also identifying elements of the case as being indicative of a hoax. Mm. The story attracted press coverage in British newspapers, has been mentioned in books, featured in TV and radio documentaries, and dramatized in the 2016 horror film The Conjuring 2. Over a period of 18 months, more than 30 people, including the Hodgson's neighbors, paranormal investigators, and journalists, said they variously saw heavy furniture moving of its own accord, objects being thrown across a room, and the sisters seeming to levitate several feet off the ground.
Whoa.
Many also heard and recorded knocking noises and a gruff voice. The story was regularly covered in the Daily Mirror newspaper until reports came to an end in 1979. According to Maurice Gross, the Warrens showed up in 1978, unannounced, and were told they were not welcome. Ed Warren claimed that the family was plagued with demonic spirits. Maurice claimed that they only stayed for one day, and that Ed said that they, the Warrens, could make a lot of money off of the case. So, there is little to no detail that I found on the Warrens' involvement with the case other than Maurice's interview in 2006. Maurice had instructed the Warrens to leave after Ed advised him, quote, there's a lot of money to be made here. So he legit said this. It wasn't just something that Maurice came up with.
That's so sad.
The more I'm finding on the Warrens and how families claim their experiences with them went down, the more I'm getting disappointed, honestly. Yeah. I'm not saying that any of these hauntings didn't happen. It's just that I've held such a high regard for the Warrens for so many years. And the more I dive into it, it's getting hard to really differentiate whether they were legitimate or not. And that makes me sad. that.
Yeah, no, really, because I idolized them for the longest time, and now that we're digging into their cases, they just kind of seem like they're more for the money than actually helping people.
Yeah, because I don't know whether the families just were mad that they didn't get the results they want and now they're talking shit, or if the Warrens were in fact just were like, oh, we're just gonna, you know, come in here, say it's demons, and then move on.
Yeah, because everything was demons.
Yeah, no, it was actually stated in an article I found that before they went in and became popularized through cases like Amityville and The Conjuring House and stuff like that, they used to just be paranormal investigators.
Right.
So when I had told that story in the first Warren Files episode, where Ed was a painter and he would go up to people's houses and offer them paintings of their houses and stuff, that's essentially how they got in. He said that he loved to paint haunted houses. He would have Lorraine take the painting up to the door and be like, oh, my husband loves to paint haunted locations. And they'd be like, oh, well, our house is haunted. And they'd let him right in.
Yeah.
That was their ticket in. But then after The Exorcist came out in theaters and the whole satanic panic thing started blowing up, suddenly every single case was demons.
Every single one.
That's why I'm like, what the hell?
It's actually quite depressing.
It is. It is. Because I have, like you, I've idolized them since I was a teenager. When my first story I heard about them was Annabelle, because it was my English teacher in high school, and he was telling us scary stories, and he even said, like, he over extra'd the whole fucking thing. He turned out the lights. He's like, if you're squeamish or get scared easily, leave the classroom now, and blah, blah, blah. And he went and told the whole story of Annabelle, and I just fell in love with it.
Yeah.
And I dived so deep into the Warrens and everything they did. And now that I'm seeing all this stuff, I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
It completely shattered my whole view of them.
Yeah.
So I don't know what to think
anymore.
And
it's hard to tell what's real and what's just fabricated.
Anyway, sorry about that, guys. Just like it hits home for us. So.
Yeah, no, this was kind of one of those dream crushing sort of feelings. Yes.
Moving on. Maurice Gross, a successful inventor, initiated an investigation soon after the start of the events on behalf of the Society for Psychical Research. Gross was soon joined by author and paranormal investigator Guy Lyon Playfair, whose 1980 book, This House is Haunted, An Investigation of the Enfield Poltergeist, is the main source of information about the events. Detailed and broadly accurate reports published over a period of time by the Daily Mirror led to widespread attention by other newspapers, radio, and television. The house itself is at 284 Green Street, and it's a three-bedroom, council-owned, semi-detached house dating from the 1920s, which was popular in London, like all those stacked rows of houses. At this time, it was occupied by a family consisting of 47-year-old divorcee Peggy Hodgson and her four children, Margaret, 13, Janet, 11, John, 11, and Billy, 7. All except Janet are referred to in This House is Haunted by pseudonyms, respectively Peggy Harper, Rose, Pete, and Jimmy. So, you know, for their identity's sake. But again, I don't know why, because they've literally been on the news.
Yeah.
Peggy Hodgson was considered by those who knew her to be a pleasant and conscientious person, overcoming financial insecurity to do her best for her children. Margaret was serious and reserved. Janet was lively and extrovert. John was only at home during the school holidays and some weekends since he boarded at a special school, and Billy suffered from a severe speech defect, but in other respects was a typical little boy. Mrs. Hodgson's family friend that she had at the time, John Burcombe, who was pretty much so close they were brother and sister.
Right.
He was a hospital worker, lived nearby at 272 Green Street with his wife Sylvia and two children, Paul and Denise. The two families appeared to be close, and John was supportive towards the Hodgsons. The Hodgsons' next door neighbors were builder Vic Nottingham, his wife Peggy, and their 20-year-old son Gary. Relations between the families were seen to be friendly and supportive. On August 31st, 1977, at around 9:30 p.m., the children, Janet and John, heard shuffling in their bedroom. Their mother entered the room, and all three heard knocking sounds. A chest of drawers moved 18 inches across the room without any apparent physical contact. They immediately went to fetch help from the Nottinghams next door. Vic and Gary Nottingham entered and heard further knocks. Vic later stated that he could find no source for the knocks, which seemed to follow him around the house. At this point, Petty Nottingham called the police. So Vic was a plumber, and he was very familiar with the typical, like, you hear knocking and stuff. He's like, oh, is it the pipes and stuff? Like, but he couldn't find any source of Yeah, so he's like, this shit's haunted. You need help.
He's like, it's not the pipes, friends. I'm sorry to tell you. In my professional opinion, you're fucked.
So WPC Heaps and PC Hyams arrived around 1 a.m. Heaps witnessed a chair move 3 to 4 feet across the living room floor without any physical context. She stated that she checked the rest of the house, checked for wires, for any type of evidence that this could be a hoax, and found nothing. She even placed a marble on the floor that she saw the chair move on to see if it was uneven, but it remained still. The two officers also reported hearing knocking sounds that they couldn't find the source of. So they just went back to the family and were basically, we're not in this, you know, this is not our area of expertise. So you need to find somebody else.
This is well above my pay grade. Sorry. Fuck this shit, I'm out.
It's like that scene from Casper. When he comes out, we're going to call somebody else. No. Oh my god, no, no. Over the next few days, marbles and toy Lego blocks appeared to fly around the house of their own volition, witnessed by members of the family and the Nottinghams. There were followed visits by council officials, clergymen, and others, but none of these deterred the phenomena, which continued unabated.
Wow.
On September 4th, Mrs. Nottingham phoned the Daily Mirror in hope it would put her in touch with someone who could help. Reporter Douglas Bence and photographer Graham Morris visited the house. Both men witnessed flying objects, and Graham was hit in the forehead by a piece of Lego traveling at high speed and had a bruise that lasted several days.
Jesus Christ.
And, yeah.
Pinged right off his forehead.
Yep. So
you in particular.
They went in initially and had the interview with them, and nothing was going on. So they were like, okay, this is, you know, this is a bust. We're leaving. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they were packing all their shit in the car, Vic came out and was like, it's starting up again. So he immediately grabbed his camera, ran back inside, and got plinked in the head with a Lego.
Wow.
But none of this is on the film because it was just a camera.
Yeah.
And it didn't look like anything was wrong in the pictures. It's so messed up.
It's probably like, you think I'm full of shit? Fuck you!
Yeah!
I'm not your dance monkey.
On September 7th, senior reporter George Fallows and photographer David Thorpe. Yeah, George Fallows and photographer David Thorpe visited the house.
Thorpe.
In early September... God damn it, Tori.
You know I have a thing for names.
I know you do. This is just, all these names are just so British.
It's funny, though, because I've seen a couple so far that you've moved through really quickly to try to avoid.
I don't know what you're talking about,
man. I've caught on very quickly.
In early September, the Daily Mirror's Fallows contacted the Society for Psychical Research, or SBR, and spoke to the secretary, Eleanor O'Keefe. O'Keefe got in touch with Maurice Gross, who had recently joined the organization, and declared his willingness to act as an investigator if any interesting cases should arise. So, according to Chairwoman Mary Rose Barrington, she said, quote, shut up, Tori. Yeah, that's what she said. She said, shut up, Tori.
She said, quote, shut up, Tori.
God damn it. Oh my god.
I'm sorry. That was great.
Mary said, quote, the society was set up in 1882 to investigate the faculties of man, real or supposed, that there are not explicable on any generated hypothesis. In other words, it's to look into weird things. End quote. I mean, at least she broke it down, because most people would be like, the fuck did you just say?
For the layman. Yeah, there's some weird shit here. We're going to check it out.
The modern day SBR has a wide range of membership, from skeptics to full-fledged believers in the paranormal. So Maurice Gross was a successful inventor, responsible among many innovations for the rotating advertising billboard. So he was the one that invented the whole, where it turns over. Yeah. His interest in paranormal phenomena had been awakened by a series of meaningful coincidences that followed the death of his daughter Janet in August of 1976 of head injuries sustained during a motorcycle accident.
Aww.
Yeah, so he got into it because he was wanting desperately to contact his daughter.
Yeah, that makes
and was
sense.
Hoping that
it's like this has to be real. This has to be real so I can talk to her again.
Mm-hmm. Which I cannot blame him for that.
Yeah, no, that honestly that's a motivator for a lot of people.
Yeah. Gross visited the house on September 5th. He advised Mrs. Hodgson to remain calm and recommended she take notes of any incidents. On September 8th, Gross and three Daily Mirror reporters witnessed a loud crash. Convinced that Hodgson's claims were genuine, Gross now decided to take on the case. During subsequent visits, he and others observed marbles that flew through the air and landed on the floor without rolling, doors and drawers that opened of their own accord, door chimes that swung, objects such as teaspoons, cardboard boxes, and fish tank lid that jumped.
A fish tank lid.
Yeah.
Jeez.
The movements were witnessed by Gross, the Hodgsons, Peggy Nottingham's father, and four reporters and photographers from the Daily Mirror. At this relatively early stage, as many as 10 people not related to the family had witnessed the phenomena at first hand. Author and investigator Guy Playfair responded to an appeal to the SBR for assistance by Gross and arrived on September 12th, along with Rosalind Morris from BBC Radio 4, The World This Weekend. He and Gross worked together for more than a year, making a total of 180 visits and 25 all-night vigils at the house. The incidents at Enfield are among the most closely recorded in any poltergeist-type case. Gross, Playfair, Mrs. Hodgson, and other witnesses kept records of varying levels of detail. Tape recordings, mainly by Playfair and Gross, eventually totaled over 180 hours.
Jesus.
An incomplete list, because it's not the whole list, but it's as follows. Marbles and pieces of Lego seen traveling through the air at great speed, seemingly emanating from walls or windows. A teapot shook vigorously on a cabinet in the absence of any external vibration. Metal spoons bent and the lid of a metal teapot was deformed.
Ugh.
The shade of a bedside lamp tilted and then straightened. It just sounds like he's trying to, he's like, oh shit, I'm sorry, and then fixes it. A toilet door opened and closed when nobody was nearby. Cardboard boxes and cushions were thrown by an unknown force. A slipper was thrown across the room by an unknown source. A framed certificate was pulled off the wall, with Gross alone in the room. A bedroom carpet was pulled up at the edge to form an identical shape each time, an effect which Gross was unable to replicate.
Wow.
A settee was levitated and overturned in front of several witnesses. 11-year-old Janet was levitated and deposited in different places at different times.
Sorry, levitated and then deposited in different places. Just whoop.
Yeah. Kitchen unit doors slid open of their own accord. Tubular door chimes swung from side to side many times. Footsteps were heard when nobody else was present. 12-year-old Margaret was held fast by an unknown force. Knocks, bangs, and crashes heard, not caused by plumbing, vibration, or any other external sources. Coins disappeared from one room and reappeared in another. Small fires started and extinguished themselves without causing damage. Water appeared in circumstances not understood. Normally reliable electrical equipment, so tape recorders, cameras, etc., failed to work. Apparitions were seen, partial and total. The iron frame of a built-in fireplace was wrenched from the wall. Excrement appeared in inappropriate places. I mean, I don't know what would be an appropriate, besides the toilet.
Yeah, the toilet.
I guess it would appear to other places, too. And written messages.
Oh, God.
The abusive remarks and swear words in a gruff masculine voice apparently produced by Janet and sometimes Margaret. Yeah.
Oh.
Some effects occurred simultaneously. Many were repeated at different times and places both day and night. Some were seen by members of the public, who in many cases had no interaction with the Hodgson family. They included John Rainbow. John Rainbow.
Wow.
A local tradesman, Richard Gross, a solicitor, and Hazel Short, a road crossing council employee, or the lollipop lady.
Oh my God. The lollipop killed.
Short told Playfair that she had been walking towards number 284 to pick up her lollipop sign, which she normally concealed under the hedge at the front of the house. She said, "I was standing there looking at the house when all of a sudden a couple of books came flying across and hit the window. It was so sudden. I heard the noise because it was so quiet. There was no traffic and it made me jump. Then after a little while, I saw Janet. I don't know if there's a bed underneath that window, but she was going up and down bodily as though someone was just tossing her up and down bodily in a horizontal position, like as if someone had got hold of her legs and back and was throwing her up and down.
What the fuck?
I definitely saw her come up about window height, but I thought if she was bouncing, she'd bounce from her feet. She wouldn't be able to get enough power to bounce off her back to come up that high. My friend could see her well. We both could see her."
That's crazy.
Yeah. So this was also included in here is Caroline Heap's report to the investigators. And she says, "On Thursday, September 1st, 1977, approximately 1 a.m., I was on duty in my capacity as a policewoman when I received a radio message to 284 Wood Street in Enfield. I went to this address where I found a number of people standing in the living room. I was told by the occupier of this house that strange things had been happening during the last few nights and that they believed the house was haunted. Myself and another PC entered the living room of the house and the occupier switched off the lights. Almost immediately, I heard the sound of knocking on the wall that backs onto the next door neighbor's house. There were four distinct taps on the wall and then silence. About 2 minutes later, I heard more tapping, but this time it was coming from a different wall. Again, it was a distinctive peal of four taps. The PC and the neighbors checked the walls, attic, and pipes, but could find nothing to explain the knockings. The PC and the neighbors all went into the kitchen to check the refrigerator, pipes, etc., leaving the family and myself in the living room. The lights in the living room were switched off again, and within a few minutes, the eldest son pointed to a chair which was standing next to the sofa. I looked at the chair and noticed that it was wobbling slightly from side to side. I then saw the chair slide across the floor towards the kitchen wall. It moved approximately 3 to 4 feet and then came to a rest. At no time did it appear to leave the floor. I checked the chair but could find nothing to explain how it had moved. The lights were switched back on. Nothing else happened that night, although we have later reports of disturbances at this address."
I can't imagine somebody who has no idea about paranormal stuff, really, and then you walk into a house and all this crazy shit is happening, and then all of a sudden a chair across the floor and you're like, nope.
Yeah, that would be, I'd be like, nope, I'm shit. Fucking out of here, man.
Like, that's a lot. That really is just straight up above my pay grade.
Yep. No. I mean, granted, if it was us, yeah, no, we would do the same thing, like, story. Check for shit, try to debunk it, right. And then pull out all the equipment.
And then I'd sit in the chair.
Yeah. What feel do you get from it? Do you hear any voices?
Be like, bitch, move me. Now there's so damn 200, powerful. There's 200 more pounds in this chair. Do it again. Do it again. Do it again.
George Fallows, a Daily Mirror reporter, gave this account of events that he witnessed. "Because of the emotional atmosphere at the house and in the neighborhood, ranging from hysteria through terror to excitement and tension, it has been difficult to record satisfactory data. Nevertheless, I am satisfied the overall impression of our investigation is reasonably accurate. To the best of our ability, we have eliminated the possibility of total trickery, although we have been able to simulate most of the phenomena. In my opinion, this faking could only be done by an expert. In December of 1977, 3 months after the start of the disturbances, an anomalous voice began to emanate from Janet. It started as a series of whistles and dog-like barks and developed into a human voice, that of an elderly male, harsh and guttural and quite unlike Janet's. The voice identified itself as Bill Wilkins, pseudonym Watson in This House is Haunted, and claimed that he had lived in the house. The previous occupant was in fact a Mr. Wilkins who had died in the house, a fact seemingly unknown to Janet. It habitually swore and claimed to be still living and to sleep in Janet's bed. Interrogated by Richard Gross, Maurice Gross's son, a solicitor, the voice gave further details, saying, I went blind and I had a hemorrhage and I fell asleep and I died on a chair in the corner downstairs.
Wow.
Yep. To eliminate the possibility that Janet was herself faking the voice, Gross taped up Janet's mouth. The voice continued to be heard, somewhat subdued, as was the case on future occasions when Janet's mouth was also filled with water. Early in January 1978, Margaret started to speak in a similar harsh voice, but without the same intensity or duration as Janet's. Many hours of recordings of the voice were made, the details of which are related in Melvin Willen's The Enfield Poltergeist tapes in 2019. A contact microphone placed on the back of Janet's head picked up what appeared to be a different and louder sound than her normal voice. A speech therapist approached by the investigators was unable to say where the sound was coming from or how it was being sustained. It had had some resemblance to a false vocal cord tone, according to her. John Hasted, a physicist at London's Birkbeck College, carried out an experiment together with Adrian Forson, a phonetics expert at University College London. Tests with a laryngograph indicated an effect known as plica ventricularis, where muscle tension in the throat can produce sounds independent of the vocal cords. However, there are known side effects in this condition, around 6 weeks of hoarseness and a sore throat, neither of which were exhibited by Janet.
Huh.
Ray Allen, a ventriloquist, felt that the voice was being produced via the diaphragm, but this was disputed by Gross and Playfair. Gross was so convinced of the paranormal origin of the effect that he offered £500, later £1,000, to a nominated charity if any child could replicate the voice under the terms he specified. Nobody took up this offer. He was further encouraged in his conviction that the voice had an unknown source when reading of similar historical cases from people suffering possession. At the moment when the countenance alters, a more or less changed voice issues from the mouth of the person in the fit. The top register of the voice is displaced, the feminine voice is transformed into a bass one. There have been more recent reports of a similar phenomenon. In 2012, Professor Richard E. Gallagher of the New York Medical College reported the case of a woman referred to as Julia, who sometimes spontaneously entered a trance state and uttered obscenities in voices completely different from her own. This is actually also a separate possession case.
Yeah.
That was, like, really fucked up.
Okay.
So we might do an episode on that one, on Julia.
Okay.
Like, yeah. I heard another actual podcast on it, and I'm like, I gotta look into this more. This is bad. In 2014, police in Indiana in the U.S. investigated a case where the children of Latoya Ammons displayed what she took to be signs of demonic possession, such as speaking in unnaturally deep voices. That's the Kentucky Hell House.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. A variety of other methods of investigation were undertaken by a number of people between August 1977 and October of 1978. In May 1978, the SBR set up a committee to examine the investigation by Gross and Playfair, consisting of Mary Rose Barrington, Hugh Pincott, Peter Halson, and John Stiles. They carefully interviewed many of the witnesses, considered much of the testimony to be clear and convincing. They also sought expertise from Charles Moses of the Southern California Society for Psychical Research, an experienced investigator. The committee concluded that there was good evidence for paranormal phenomena described by credible informants, though judgment was reserved on incidents that could not have been clearly observed or where witnesses were found to not be entirely convincing. They were wary of attributing a paranormal origin to Janet's other voice. Barrington felt personally satisfied that the paranormal events took place at Enfield and considered the tearing away of the fireplace an item of poltergeistery of the first order.
What?
Wow, that's a hell of a statement. I'm gonna use that from now on.
Poltergeistery
of the first order.
This is like the dumb fuckery sort of shit.
Physicist John Hasted found that Janet's body increased in weight when she was strapped to a Blundell couch devised to measure such anomalies. He reported two sudden 5-second weight increase signals of about 1 kilogram and a minute gradual weight increase, which eventually returned to normal, an anomaly he was unable to explain. He was further intrigued by a light bulb that exploded in an unusual way, finding that one of the glass supports on which the filament was mounted had snapped, an event he considered very rare.
Wow.
Physicist David Robertson carried out experiments at Enfield. He attempted to video Janet secretly, but found it impossible to conceal the equipment from her. He reported a levitation of Janet, the teleportation of a large cushion to the house roof, the overturning of a sideboard, his head being struck by a flying plate,
ow,
his hair pulled when he slept on the floor of the front room.
Jesus fucking Christ.
A local psychiatrist examined the girls and maintained that if they were left alone, then the disturbances would stop. This did not happen, however.
Of course, no, because everybody's like, oh, what the fuck is happening here?
Yeah.
We gotta figure it out. Just leave shit alone.
Yeah, Janet was given a detailed physical and psychological assessment at London's Maudsley Institute of Neuropsychiatry by Dr. Peter Fenwick. No abnormality was discovered, such as damage to the brain or evidence of epilepsy. Hypnosis similarly failed to uncover any evidence of psychological frailty. Playfair undertook some research that found similarities with some manifestations of Tourette's syndrome, including explosive utterances, barking, and swearing. When medical doctors were called out, they usually prescribed calming drugs to help Janet sleep. National press reporters, photographers, and television crews used different approaches to try to uncover the reason for the phenomena. Some introduced professional magicians to try to discover fraudulent activity. Others brought spirit mediums to make contact with the haunting entity. Two Brazilian mediums, Luiz Gasparetto and Elsie de Bugras, apparently had some beneficial effect on Janet's behavior. A somewhat theatrical performance by another medium, Gary Sherrick, also resulted in relative calm for a short while. Yeah, so they brought in a bunch of people.
Fucking mediums and magicians.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, I guess tackle it from every direction.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
They're at a point where they're like, the fuck is causing this? What's going on? We don't know.
We've tried all the scientific routes. Let's just start throwing shit until something sticks.
I pulled a rabbit out of a hat. It wasn't you. It was the poltergeist. Like, what the fuck?
I mean, there's a cushion on the roof now.
Sleight of hand.
That's gotta be a fucking crazy one to try and pull off.
Oh my god.
Bye. Holy shit.
I want to keep the podcast focused on content that entertains, informs, and is mindful of your time. One way to accomplish this is direct listener support. Your support would help the show grow so much, so I've set up a link where you can quickly and easily support the show. The whole thing will take 30 seconds. It's glow.fm/somethingwicked. That's glow.fm/somethingwicked. We're asking for $3 a month, but you can contribute as much or as little as you'd like. If Something Wicked is part of your day or week and you love what we're doing, please visit glow.fm/somethingwicked and support us any way you can today. It's dead simple and again will take no more than 30 seconds. Click the link in the show notes, pay with Apple or Google Pay, and click the link of the podcast player that you want to use. You can listen anywhere at any time. Happy listening! Matthew Manning, a healer and psychic, visited the Hodgsons wishing to share knowledge of such events from his own experiences, which he believed originated from an individual's own energy. Manning said he had experienced headaches of a similar nature to Peggy Hodgson's at times when phenomena was about to take place. Dono Melig Maling, a Dutch healer. That doesn't sound Dutch to me. That does not sound, Maling does not sound Dutch to me.
No, that sounds some sort of like Asian Korean. Yeah.
A Dutch healer and clairvoyant visited in October 1978, finding connections between the incidents and death of Gross's daughter. Gross and Playfair conceded that Margaret and Janet had sometimes tried to trick them, but insisted these occasions were very few, that they were quickly discovered, and that the girls had then admitted their deceit. Indeed, they held that it would have not been normal if the children had not tried to copy what they were seeing happen all around them.
Right.
You know, again, there maybe it's their own way of debunking, or they're just kind of trying to play it off or some shit. I don't know. Janet later admitted that they had cheated about 2% of the time. The family and direct neighbors believe the phenomena to be real. Those who knew Peggy Hodgson had no doubts about her personal integrity. However, some potentially credible witnesses disputed the veracity of the phenomena, often after just a few visits, and in some cases without having visited at all. Media coverage was typically trivial and sensationalist, with headlines such as Terror for Family and Spook Riddle. The hell?
What?
Ghost Hunters clash over mystery of spook or spoof kids.
Spook and, or spoof.
Yeah. And Phantom Fred is a force to fear.
What the fuck?
Accompanied by a ghostly image of Playfair.
What?
Phantom Fred.
Phantom Fred.
This House is Haunted was published in 1980. It was reviewed skeptically by Anita Gregory, an SBR member and investigator who had visited Enfield with John Boloff in December of 1977. The pair argued that the girls enjoyed play acting. Gregory alleged that John Burkham told her that Janet taught herself the trick of talking in a deep voice and that she enjoyed keeping strangers hopping about. Gregory also stated that Peggy Nottingham had told her that what was going on now was pure nonsense and it was kept going by the investigators. After rejoinders from Gross, Gregory repeated her suspicion regarding the paranormality of the girls' voices and her belief that Playfair's book was far too sketchy, unsystematic, imprecise, ambiguous, and confusing to be seen as a contribution to research. I don't think that's what it meant to be. I think it was just an account of what happened. Melvin Harris, an author of debunking books, analyzed the photographs in This House is Haunted, concluding they showed the girls indulging in spirited hijinks and forcefully denying that they could be held to represent paranormal events. In reply, Playfair defended the photographs as follows. On the curtain twisting sequence, Harris suggests that the curtain has simply been hit by the bedclothes and knocked off the window ledge. He does not explain how the curtain then moves into the room, as it can be plainly seen to do in the first picture instead of towards the window, as one might expect. Nor does he explain how it moves to the right, the opposite direction to that of the bedclothes, and then twists into a tight spiral. In the pillow sequence, he does not explain how the top pillow doubles up in midair and changes direction, which it clearly does. Had both pillows been thrown with one hand by Rose, they would presumably have followed the same trajectory and landed together, which they did not. Such movements, he says, easily correspond with those to be found in commonplace, everyday events. Not in the world I live in. I mean, if you saw two pillows fly up and, like, shoot off in different directions, it's... I mean, yes, you can if you do with both hands, but if you're supposedly throwing it with one hand, they'd go in the same direction. Or if the curtain just decided to move to the side and then twist and twist on its own, it's like, that's a little...
You have any toddlers here? No? All right.
Got carry up in this bitch? Like,
right?
In later response to Gregory, Gross defended himself against her criticisms and pointed out that she had conceded the case included some good evidence and testimony, being answered in turn by Gregory with more criticisms, including a complaint about the lack of evidential video footage. It was the 70s.
Dance monkeys.
I know that camcorders and stuff existed back then. I get it.
But good ones.
No. Gross and Playfair published further reflections some years later. Here they drew attention to the large number of written and spoken testimonies from witnesses. They described in detail the constant and anomalous problems that they had and professionals had experienced with the sound and video recording equipment when trying to capture evidence. They bewailed the lack of balance shown in some sections of the media, denouncing the many inaccuracies, distortions, half-truths, and blatant lies about the Enfield case that have found their way over the years into print or radio and TV programs. Some journalists, they revealed, had tried unsuccessfully to bribe a next-door neighbor, Mrs. Nottingham, with £1,000 if she would state that the events were all a pack of lies. She and her family subsequently made signed statements repudiating allegations of faking. So, yeah, they just went to her and were just like, we'll pay you £1,000 if you say this is all fake. And she's like, nah.
Fuck you.
Which would be something hard to pass up in the type of area and economy that they lived in.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, if you were broke as fuck, you were living off of welfare, and somebody was like, I'm gonna give you $1,000 just to say this. Like, I'd take it, unless it was real and it was happening to a close friend of mine.
Exactly.
In 2012, Janet appeared on the television program This Morning with Playfair and Deborah Hyde, editor of The Skeptic magazine. Criticism by Hyde of views put forward by Mary Rose Barrington led to correspondence by both parties in later edition of the magazine. Barrister and SPR council member Alan Murdy returned to the topic in a later magazine article, arguing that Hyde had wasted an opportunity to ask detailed questions, preferring instead to speak in generalizations. Towards the end of his life, Gross was much occupied with defending his investigation of the Enfield events, writing articles for a wide range of publications, and speaking at conferences. In 1995, he took part in an edition of the popular ITV television program Strange But True with presenter Michael Aspel. 2 years later, having been attacked by the psychologist Nicholas Humphreys on Channel 4's Is There Anybody There?, he appeared in its Right to Reply program to give his version of the events. A dispute arose over the 1992 BBC drama Ghost Watch, which was modeled on some aspects of the Enfield case. Playfair received a settlement out of court. In 1998, Gross took court action against the comedian David Baddiel for giving his name to a character in his novel Time for Bed, a psychic investigator who runs away with a married woman. Baddiel paid out of court and the winnings went to charity. So I actually watched Ghost Watch.
Right.
I found it on, was it on YouTube or Vimeo? One of the two. But I found it online, essentially. And the way they did it is they presented it as it was real news footage.
Okay.
People were thinking they were watching breaking news. And it was a story of something that was modeled after the Enfield case. And it was like people that were watching at home were like getting sick, were going to churches, going into seizures.
Freaking the fuck out.
Like, they actually did a better job than the Blair Witch Project.
That's fucking hilarious.
As far as advertising it and broadcasting it, it was ridiculous. It was the equivalency, I would say, as the original broadcast of War of the Worlds, when people thought aliens were really actually fucking here and attacking everybody. Like, that's the level of fear it incited.
That's crazy.
And it got banned, so you can now only find it on some random shit on the internet.
Oh my god. I need to see this.
Gross appeared in a French documentary, The Strange Odyssey, in 1995. He was interviewed by a Japanese film company in 1996, at which time Terry Wilkins, son of the former occupant of the Enfield house, and putative entity Bill Wilkins, confirmed that his father had died in the house many years earlier in the circumstances that Janet's voice had described. And Gross passed away in 2006. Playfair remained an active researcher, author, and SBR council member almost until his death in 2018. He vigorously defended the legitimacy of the investigation and the claims of paranormality. In 2007, he took the Times to task for making unfounded comments about the case. Playfair also pointed to support from the academic community for his comparisons of features of the case with Tourette's syndrome. Peggy Hodgson died in 2003. Her older son, John, died in 1981 at age 14.
Aww.
Yeah. Janet left home at 16, married young, and suffered the loss of her son when she was aged 18. Maurice Gross died in 2006 and Guy Playfair in 2018.
Jesus.
Yeah. Peggy Hodgson avoided publicity after the disturbances subsided in 1978, but never changed her position about the anomalous nature of what she had experienced. Billy, a young child at the time, remained largely indifferent to the events. Both Janet and Margaret had made brief appearances on the television documentaries, insisting on the genuineness of the phenomena.
Okay.
Asked in a 2011 newspaper article whether she believed the house was still haunted, Janet said, quote, "Years later, when Mum was alive, there was always a presence there, something watching over you." Janet, who was at this time was age 45, mentioned having been bullied at school as a result of the incidents, being nicknamed Ghost Girl. She also mentioned having played with a Ouija board before the trouble flared up.
Oh, no. Oh, come on.
Well, that's your damn fault. Sorry. But she said she had been unaware that she went into trances until shown the photographs. She quoted, "I knew when the voices were happening, of course. It felt like something was behind me all of the time. They did all sorts of tests, filling my mouth with water and so on. But the voices still came out. The levitation was scary because you didn't know where you were going to land. I remember a curtain being wound around my neck. I was screaming. I thought I was going to die."
Jesus Christ.
After Peggy Hodgson died, the house was briefly occupied by mother of four, Claire Bennett, who stated, "I didn't see anything, but I felt uncomfortable. There was definitely some kind of presence in the house. I always felt like someone was looking at me." Her sons would wake in the night hearing people talking downstairs. Bennett then found out about the house's history. "Suddenly, it all made sense," she said. "The family moved out after just 2 months." Steven Spielberg's Poltergeist was based on a documented haunting in England, presumably Enfield, according to the film's scriptwriter, Dan Aykroyd.
I mean, that would make a lot of sense, honestly.
Yeah. A three-part dramatization of the events was broadcast in May of 2015 by Sky Living under the title The Enfield Haunting, featuring Timothy Spall as Maurice Gross and Matthew McFadden as Guy Playfair. I have not seen it, but I have to because Darcy.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Best version of him ever. One thing about me, besides the fact that I'm absolutely obsessed with horror, is romantic period pieces.
Yep.
Are my bread and butter and a guilty pleasure. And Pride and Prejudice is one of my favorite movies of all time. And Matthew McFadden is the best Darcy ever. So I have to see this. Anyway, Playfair was consulted by the program makers, but commented later that the result bore little relation to the actual events, with almost none of the phenomena shown having anything to do with the real ones.
Which, I don't understand why they would do that, because there was so many different fucking things that happened. Why do you have to go and make up more shit?
Yeah.
Like, there was enough material there, I promise.
Yeah. The program contained notable inaccuracies, such as the use of CCTV, not available at the time, no shit. And omitted key features such as Janet's alleged levitation. Like, why would you not include those, though?
Yeah, really.
And why is CCT? You know, oh my god. I also can't stand historical inaccuracies. I can't. There was no such thing as CCTV back in the 70s. That hurts my brain.
Yeah, I can see it.
One of the most controversial aspects of the Enfield case that I will talk about in more detail in part two, an aspect that often gets more attention than is warranted, is the voice that allegedly was manifested by the poltergeist. Despite the large amount of attention the phenomena received, interpretations of the voice, both in support of its paranormality and against it, are usually remarkably simplistic. That's partly because the large majority of people commenting on the subject have only heard a small percentage of what the voice said, but even what they say about that small percentage is often unreasonable. One of the most surprising aspects of the Enfield tapes is how often the poltergeist is reported to have spoken audibly independently of the Hodgson children. I don't remember any radio or television program about the Enfield case discussing any of these incidents, and Playfair's book doesn't mention most of them. The number of occasions when the poltergeist was thought to have audibly spoken independent of the Hodgson children is at least in the double digits. Gross goes as far as to say that practically everybody had heard the poltergeist speaking in a disembodied way. Thanks so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. Tune in next time for part two of the Enfield Poltergeist. Don't forget to follow us on Anchor, show us some loves on Glow, grab your merch at the official Something Wicked store, and hop on over to our Facebook group for updates on upcoming episodes.
Later!